to the comic review, The Return.
Woo!
We're fresh off of Heroes Con, which was only a mere 3-4 months ago.
Yeah, man. We are fresh like styrofoam.
I'm Adam Buccafusco. Joining with me today is Gabriel Dunston.
I don't have a Gabriel V something yet, but I'm working on it.
True. Sequoia is setting this one out. We'll hopefully continue the show and get him back on it. And,
Sequoia, if you are listening, buddy, you are missed.
Missed! What's up?
A bit of talking shop. How are my... I'm sitting kind of far back and I'm talking low. Are my levels good?
Do I need to stick up?
Ooh, then you're like sultry.
Am I sexy?
Am I sexy? There you go. So it's been a couple months. Here's the thing. DAM Radio has been on a little bit of a hiatus because some of us got married. Some of us are getting married. Yeah, some of us bought a house. Some of us got in a car accident and had to get a new car.
Life changes.
Life happens. I feel really regretful that I've let it kind of simmer this long, but I feel even more glad to be back doing this. I miss it, man. Like I'm just going to go ahead and throw it out. The first one since being back, I fucking miss doing this. And
yeah.
It's really hard sometimes to do it as constantly as we were doing it. Our sister show, Damn Art Majors, as you may know, was like practically a weekly show.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
And hopefully will be again.
Hopefully. It's got to be retooled a little bit. It's got to be worked out. You know, we're part of the problem. And this is going to be kind of some of the topics we're going to talk about today on No Bake 2 Comic Review. We are going to review some comics, but we are going to talk about life as artists
it's kind of art. Kind of a grow or die period.
Part of the problem that I think we were having is that I can't speak for the others, but I'm an artist who happens to do a podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And after having the great experience at VAE doing the live show and having the great experience at Heroes Con, getting a report from there, mm-hmm. and, you know, turning out weekly episodes of Damn Art Majors as well as monthly episodes of No Big Two Comic Review, I started to realize, wait a minute. I'm a podcaster who just happens to be an artist.
Yeah, yeah.
And something really had to change.
You know, there's this beautiful Neil Gaiman story where he put out some books. It's the moment where Neil Gaiman hit and he became a name in the industry. It's part of that very famous graduation speech he gave. And he said, I reached the moment where I realized that I answer fan emails professionally and I write in my spare time.
Yeah. So
it's
all about finding that balance.
It happens to pretty much everyone who actively seeks to do something. Ringo Starr, for instance, God bless that man. He's a Beatle. He physically writes responses to every single piece of fan mail. Now, he is a Beatle. Beatlemania was a thing. For Ringo Starr to have done that is incredible. He puts out this video in, I want to say, 2007, 2008, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, look, get whatever you've got to me by October 7th, something. It's like, if it's postmarked after that, I'm not going to answer because I'm old and I'm going to die soon and I've got things I need to do. If it's postmarked before then, I will respond. I'll respond to all of them. But after that, I'm done because I can't just do this with my life.
And did you hear about the woman who painted Ringo's portrait? And 20 years later, he tracked her down?
I heard about the time I punched you in the nuts for making a sad, sad Simpsons reference.
Yes.
Man.
Classic.
Oh,
I miss podcasting.
Man.
Making an ass out of myself.
Sitting too far away for me to punch you in the nuts. I now understand how strategic the seating arrangement is. Oh, speaking as a listener, I have missed this podcast. This one right here. Yes,
yeah.
Dear gravy, yes.
So, what have you been reading lately?
Okay, now the most recent thing I'm reading, I'm going back into the only Black Sad book I own right now. It'll change come Christmas. The only one I own is the latest one called Amarillo. I'm a big fan of film noir, just any kind of noir. And I'm starting to, this is going to sound pretentious as hell, but I'm starting to refine my palette in that direction. I listened to an audio drama called Blackjack Justice from Dakota Ring Theater, DakotaRingTheater.com. And it was, they're starting their 11th season of this show. It's an audio drama, like an old time, it sounds like an old time radio show, but they've been making these regularly since 2006.
Sure.
And it's got this, it's wonderful to listen to while I'm working. And I've been strapped to my drawing table a lot lately. So I'm listening to it, and so when I'm reading comics, I go and I grab all of my noir comics to see how they handle the storytelling, because a lot of the noir stories, especially the ones where fun is an important part of it, it's very, very dialogue-y. Banter, fast, witty banter is very, very important. Like Sam Spade, like the thing that made Bogart great was Bogart. If you give him a good line, he'll deliver it better than anyone else.
Right.
So just that's one of the things about film noir. The main characters, the private eye or whatever, has to be very charming, and it's because they're quick witted and their banter is great. And the comic I've been working on for ages, Purgatory Pub, is all dialogue driven, and drawing something dialogue driven, the ratio of text to panel. It's delicate, because if you have one panel and a wall of text, it's a turnoff. But if you have a panel and a little bit of text, you're spending a lot of time for a very small amount of payout for the reader. So I'm doing a deep dive of all of my noir books to see how they handle the situation. So I'm rereading Black Sad Amarillo, and I'm rereading the Parker books that Darwin Cook put out. My favorite one, if you only read one of them, I recommend Parker the Outfit. It's a series, so you've got Parker the Hunter, Parker the Outfit, and then the one after, I can't remember, it's like the Hunted or something. I recommend the Outfit. What Darwin Cook does is beautiful. He switches to three different methods of storytelling and three different art styles. He has to inundate you with a lot of information, but keep it interesting and keep it reading very quickly. And he does it in three or four different ways. It's at its heart a heist story with lots of little heists in the middle. And he has to describe these little heists in a way that's complete and satisfying, but also quick and to the point, so that you're not bored and you don't get tired of hearing about another heist.
Sure.
Prior to that, actually, I found a short comic miniseries that I fell in love with very quickly, and it's called Long Distance, and I'm kicking myself in the face right now. I can't remember the guy who did it.
You're kicking yourself. It's I didn't know you were so flexible.
Frankly, it is. You know, it's not flexible, as I've got a trick knee that goes both ways.
That's what that is.
Yeah, it's actually extremely painful. I'm just a boss, and I can hide it. I can't remember his name. He's the guy who did Love and Capes, I think. Not Capes and Babes, but like Love and Capes. Anyhow, it's put out by IDW. It's a 4-issue miniseries, and it's a romance story. And it's called Long Distance, and it's about a long-distance relationship. These two people meet in a New York City airport. One of them goes to Chicago. One of them goes to Columbus, Ohio. And it's about their long-distance relationship and how they get together. And it's a romantic comedy, but without any of the sad, sad tropiness of the rom-coms you'd see in the movies. And first, each issue is something like 40 to 48 pages.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. You get a good chunk of story. Two, romantic stories are also, by their nature, very, very dialogue-y. So it's interesting to see how they handle that. And because it's about long distance, these people tweet to each other a lot. They email back and forth. They instant message all the time. They have to talk on the phone. And so seeing the visual ways he handles that, something that people don't think about a whole lot is like, if I'm one person has to type something to the other, do I make a digital image of what they're typing and then just put that into the book, or do I physically draw something that looks like a digital image?
Right.
Do you type your lettering in Helvetica New, or do you take out your pen and try to ape Helvetica New?
Just type it. My God, just type it.
Yeah, yeah, but the trick is, if you type it, then it kind of, it's a little bit stunting. It takes you out of the story. And this guy hand wrote it.
Wow.
Yeah. Now the trick is he did it in such a way that his hand is very, very faithful to the original font. But because you can't avoid being human, there's just enough wibble wobble and just enough inconsistency
enough to let you know that
just enough to let you to A, a human hand did this, and B, it visually fits. There's it's not jarring. It fits. Cool. And something that people don't think about a lot is just the speech bubbles. The font and the bubbles themselves have to look as though they belong with that imagery.
Right.
And the reason people don't think about it is because if it's done well, then you won't think about it ever. The whole point is the more invisible it is, the better it did its job. So Long Distance is a great series, and I've learned a lot from it. I haven't reread it yet, but I'm about to.
So you had recommended a book, I believe, when you were on Damn Art Majors, and I've read it pretty much cover to cover. It's also a romantic story, coming of age story, box office poison.
Oh yeah, totally.
There is a lot of complexity to the characters in Box Office Poison. It's very,
very real people.
It's very real people. It's very 90s. So this is the romantic comedy of, you know, your Kevin Smiths. In fact, there's plenty of Kevin Smith references throughout that book.
Yeah.
You know, your like Empire Records. I mean, like, that's the shit I grew up on. Yeah, so like, well, to read that book, it was just like, I wish I was that age at that time. Like,
as comics guys, both of us do, because the industry was at once a lot sadder than it is now, but at the other time, on the other hand, a lot better than it is now.
Right.
For instance,
a little less corporate than it is now.
Yeah. Well, like, for instance, if Jeff Smith came out with Bone now, Diamond would kill it after issue two because it wouldn't have made enough copies for Diamond to keep it going. But because Bone came out when it did, people were willing to give it a chance.
Right.
And it became one of the greatest works of not just comics, but as far as I'm concerned, one of the greatest works of art ever. It's up there next to Book of Kells, as far as I'm concerned. And Book of Kells, for those who don't know, is a very, very famous copy of the Bible made by hand by Irish monks. I won't get into it, but it's very ornate.
I actually know this because I worked on a project called Calligraphy Corner, and it was mentioned in it. Anyway,
yeah,
not to talk about that, but
ironically, in the 90s, they paid out way, way more money.
Did they really?
Yes.
Huh.
I was talking to this one woman at Heroes, and she did all ages books in the 90s, and she did pencils and inks. And what would happen is, and it's like comics like Tiny Toons.
Yeah.
You know, just the kids thing that would come out in the 90s, which they were not popular. I cannot stress enough how absolutely dismal the kids comics market was in the 90s. However, the publisher would pay $100 a page for the pencils. And if you did pencils and inks, it was $175, $200 a page. And then if your issue paid out, they would issue you a royalty. It was very, very, according to this artist, it was very, very low. By the time it got to her, it's like $20, $15. But it's a $15 check that appeared out of nowhere. And then when the book goes into a trade, she gets another royalty check. Mm-hmm. And again, it's like $25, but it appears. Just free money. It just appears. Now, IDW makes a lot of kids' books. IDW pays $50 for pencils and inks per page. And if you want any kind of residuals or any kind of royalties, give me cuss.
Yeah.
Okay. If you want any residuals or any royalties, go fuck yourself.
Well, so $200 back in 93 would be the equivalent of like $350 today.
Yeah, $200, 1993.
$50, 2015 is $50, 2015.
What it breaks down to is somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 to $3 an hour.
Wow.
Yeah. In the 90s, making comics professionally as a working cartoonist, not somebody working at one of the big two making a major title, but just working cartoonists doing little anthology bits or an issue at a time of some kid's thing, whatever, you could make a living. You could, if you lived in a place where the cost of living was nice and low, you could make an all right living as long as you're willing to live very plain. Like Todd McFarlane said, if you're willing to eat macaroni and cheese for a month
to wait for the checks to come in, yeah, comics is a fine business.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to be lean for that 1 month. And that's for a guy who's working at Marvel.
Right.
If you're working outside of Marvel, it's leaner, but it was more or less true from the people that I've spoken to.
Right.
And for some reason, self-published books were... The numbers say that self-published books were more accepted than they are now, which in terms of print comic market.
Right.
Which is very, very strange because people love independent comics kind of right now. There's so many webcomics that have blown the heck up, but at the same time, if you go around and you talk to the people who are making indie comics, it's sad. It is a sad, sad state of affairs. Like, comic shops are posting more profits than they've made in the last 10 years. The publishers Marvel and DC are doing all right. Dark Horse and IDW have been doing all right. Some very new publishers have made some great traction. Action Lab, for instance, is only 5 years old, and they're doing okay. Now, I know that I hear that the people who actually work at Action Lab, the business itself is paying for itself.
Well, that's
and
good.
The people who actually work, like the publisher, the editor, that those guys aren't really drawing any checks. But the publisher itself is paying its own bills in a time where Dan Votto of Slave Labor Graphics, which made huge impact on the industry and the art form in general, is in trouble. It's such a mixed bag of sad and sweetness in the comics business right now.
Well, right, the latest thing I've heard is that Valiant is coming back in a big bad way.
Yeah,
somebody... I was not aware until like recently, but it now, like, I'm since I learned this bit of information, like, things are connecting. But Valiant used to be owned by none other than Acclaim Games.
Yes, that is correct.
Thus, the Shadow Man video game for N64.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Shadow Man is a Valiant comic. Well, Valiant, I think, has become self-sustaining within the last, like, 5 to 10 years.
Somewhere in there, yeah.
And from what I'm reading, they're putting out top grade books. Nobody's reading them.
Yeah.
But they're putting out so good, like, material that's so good and so untainted that Universal Studios has just bought the movie rights to all of Valiant.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to meet the publisher, the chief guy in charge of Valiant, sweetheart guy, and straight up fan with a capital F.
Mm-hmm.
And he is sparing no expense. Like, he goes out of his way to hire talent. It's like, I want people who are good, and I'm willing to pay them what it takes.
Right.
And I mean, to my knowledge, Valiant can't pay out that much, but the people, I haven't heard anyone do work for Valiant complain.
Right.
And I'm first of all, people love to complain.
Sure.
And I'm in a position where people are willing to complain to me because I'll keep their name out of it. And because they've seen me at cons enough to know that I'm a member of the club, so to speak.
Right.
I've never heard anybody complain. And in fact, one of my very good comic friends, Rafer Roberts, it was just announced just this weekend that he's going to be writing the next title, A&A. I forget what it's...
Archer and Armstrong?
Thank you, Archer and Armstrong, which they're renaming A&A so that you know it's the next phase of the story.
Got it.
But they just hired him on to write the book, and we haven't had a chance to talk about it too much, but the wee bit that I've heard is he is so freaking stoked. And he's been making comics for a long time. He's been in the indie comics and self-publishing trenches for a long, long time, and he is so happy.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah, so
I just ordered, I know Amazon's having a big Valiant sale right now, so I just got a couple of trade paperbacks. Absolutely. To kind of familiarize myself with these characters. I do feel like, for someone who started a podcast that was supposed to be dedicated to comics that aren't Marvel and DC, I really neglected Valiant.
Yeah, I can see
that. To those Valiant reps, all zero of you listening, I'm sorry. So I'm going to educate myself. I'm going to learn
a big back catalog.
You got to start with what's happening now and then work your way back, I guess.
So?
Well, you know, like, everybody would love to start with, you know, Amazing Fantastic #1 and then figure out the rest of, you know, just continue Spider-Man to issue 700, but like, who's really doing that? Nobody.
So, anyone who tries will get to the Clone Saga and be like, you know what, never mind.
Yeah, so there you go, there's that.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna read the newer stuff that every, you know, that they're saying is really groundbreaking, and yeah, check that out, and then maybe we'll do another episode in a couple weeks, and I'll let you know what I think of it.
Yeah, Adam, what else are you reading, man?
So, all right, what am I reading? Comics, like, yeah, podcasts, comics have taken a little bit of a back burner in the last couple of weeks, and I do feel bad, but I have picked up my stuff and I started reading. Continuing Fight Club 2 with Chuck Palahniuk.
That's very interesting. I see it. I really like the movie. It's mm-hmm. something that I'll have on while I'm drawing.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big deal movie when I saw it. Of course, I was like 13, so
it was a fan of Chuck Palahniuk. I've read, off the top of my head, 7 of his books.
Yeah.
It gets to a point where you start to realize, like, he's writing the same character, at least writing the same voice over and over again.
Yeah.
This is interesting because it's his first time adapting a story to comics. He's never written a comic before. You know, he lives in Portland. I believe Sequoia and I talked about this one episode. He's got a bunch of comic friends in Portland because of Dark Horse and everything. So
everybody's in Portland.
So they convinced him to do Fight Club 2 as a comic. And I don't think he really understood the writing form for sequential art, but issue 4 just came out a couple weeks ago, and he's getting it. He's starting to realize there's tricks you can do with a visual medium such as this that you can't do in a movie, that you can't do in a novel. And there's this thing, without giving any real like spoilers, like there's a scene where the main character just downs a bunch of pills, and he just grabs a bunch of pills and he just downs them. So the next series of panels are these vector, they're showing the actions that that follow the pills. Like, they get on a plane, they go over here, they go over there, but all the faces are covered by these vector realistic style looking pills.
Mm.
So like, you don't get to really see who's doing what because of these pills laying on top of their heads.
That's great.
And it was like, all right, he's getting it. He's getting that you can, with this medium, tell a story in a way that a movie cannot, because you cannot really have people walking down the street with a giant pill covering their head. It doesn't make sense.
Right.
But it does here. It looks like somebody threw pills on the comic, and they just happen to all land on the characters' heads.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Now, what's really interesting to me is I feel like the end of Fight Club was just, here's the end.
Right.
And if there was any kind of sequel, it'd be hackneyed and sad.
It is. It's not done. And, you know, like, maybe Chuck Palahniuk is all about that last act.
So maybe he'll pull it out.
Maybe he'll pull it out. But, like, issue 4, I'm still just going, like, maybe he did this as a comic to hide the fact that he even did it.
Yeah.
A little bit. Like, I'll just put it out as a comic, and, like, my main readership won't, like, even realize I did it or whatever. But moving on, Colder is back. Colder is one of the freakiest comics I have ever read. That and Sabrina, of course, but I will always say Sabrina is one of the freakiest comics.
Mm-hmm.
It deals a lot with mental health issues, only they personify them. And it's just some real gritty, nasty stuff,
mm-hmm.
dealing with fear, anxiety, depression, stress. That little voice in your head that, like, you know, like schizophrenics would have, or somebody with severe depression that's always just like, do it. Like, mm-hmm. that kind of character is portrayed in these books, and like, it's chilling.
All right, man.
Yeah. So Colder is Dark Horse, of course, because they always put out the darker stuff. Trying to think, Saga just kind of went on hiatus. Love and Archie. Oh my god, I cannot. I know this is no big two. It's just Archie podcast. Friggin' love everything Archie's doing. I know Chip Zdarsky's coming out with his Jughead run. Uh-huh. He's writing this opposed to illustrating it. Sex Criminals is probably, it's fun. It's continuing its thing. I mean, I'm not expecting too much out of it at this point. But I don't know Chip Zdarsky to be much of a writer. I'm sure he's written before. I'm just not familiar with it.
Yeah.
So I'm interested to see what he does with good old Juggy. That'll be fun. I'm telling you, dude, this Mark Waid, Fiona Staples, Archie run, it's like teen drama done intelligently.
Hmm.
It's really smart. It's really engaging. I'm pushing 30, and I'm just like, I know exactly what they're talking about. Like, yeah. I don't feel like an old guy who's like, I don't understand these damn kids.
Yeah.
I'm right there with them, and I'm like, I get that. Like, this transcends teenagers. This transcends... preteens probably wouldn't even get, like, a lot of the subtleties of it. Like, there's just so much, like, growing up that happens. And it's only on its third issue. You know, like, we're not deep in that story at all.
Yeah.
So, definitely check out Archie. Sabrina is, like I said, metal. So friggin' dark. It's crazy. But yeah, like, Descender. Really digging Descender. It's my boy Jeff Lemire. He's not really my boy. I don't know him. And David Nguyen. Love his art style. I love the, like, the watercolor kind of texture that he does with inks. And,
yeah,
you know, it's the plot is, you know, on par with, like, AI with Haley Joel Osment, like, little boy robot trying to find his place in the universe.
Yeah.
Really good. It got optioned for a movie before the first issue even dropped, which was pretty awesome. I think it's on its fifth issue now, and I want to see this movie. I want to see it as a movie, but more so, I want to keep reading it. The art's brilliant. The story is really complex. It's really emotional for a robot comic. I love robots, so
there you go. Yeah, no, I know that.
I don't actually want real robots to take over the human race, but
yeah,
I love the idea of fictional robots.
I'm with you. Also, robots are just fun as hell to draw.
They are.
There's an illustrator you should look up named Jake Parker. MrJakeParker.com. Dude loves drawing machines and stuff, and he does some mean robots. Well, I mean, they look nice. Mean robots, as in he draws them a lot and very well.
Nice.
He and the guys from Creature Box, they like their robots.
If you'd like to hear an interview with Creature Box, please tune into the last episode of...
I listened to that sucker Damn twice. No, it was on Damn Art Majors.
Yeah,
it's not
right.
The last episode.
Yeah, you're right.
It's one of the Heroes Con on location episodes. Yep. I want to say part two. It was delightful.
Yeah. It was a really good time. Really good guys.
Yeah. All right, man. So you read Box Office Poison.
Yes.
Now, this is one of those, for those of you listening, Box Office Poison was written and drawn by Alex Robinson in the 90s.
It is for mature readers. It may look kind of kid-friendly. Not kid-friendly.
It's a black and white indie. It's a slice of life story. It's about people in their 20s just outside of college and just that stage of life. And it goes from the like, think of the sitcom Friends, just where they are. And then just, like, everybody kind of gets married and moves into their little zones where they... It's that weird transition period between being a student and becoming a full adult. It's what it's about. And it's a good 600, 700 pages. It took him something like... In the neighborhood of 10 years, maybe less.
It seems like it was a decade's worth of material.
It's a big, thick book. It's and like we mentioned, I feel like an hour ago, it's very, very 90s because that's when it was coming out. And for my money, like in terms of the greatest English language comics ever made, you've got Contract with God, The Watchmen, Asterios Polyp, Bone. This is in no order. Asterios Polyp, Bone, and this book. Like, they're all on the same shelf in terms of this is some of the best English comics ever made.
With that being said, there are plenty of typos in Box Office Poison.
Completely hand-lettered.
I have to wonder if the typos were intentional or not, as if to, like, add that dialect, like you would read in, like, Huck Finn.
Yeah.
But, like, the fact that, like, he still spells the word a lot as one word, I'm just like, why would you do that? Like, you've gotten to page, like, 527. Yeah. Why are you still writing a lot opposed to a lot?
Maybe he just never learned the lesson. Like, English is my degree. I got a degree in writing. I still can't spell embarrassing for just irony. I can't. I'm embarrassed because I can't spell embarrassing. I can't spell guarantee.
I can't spell that. I
have trouble spelling restaurant. So, all right. Yeah. Anyway, it might just be a problem. Here's one for you.
Every time I mean to spell the word tell, I write the word let because of my dyslexia.
Damn. All right. So that's context. And that's my opinion of this book. But I want to hear Adam. I want to hear what you've, I can gush for hours about this book's amazing, but you know, I want to hear you, man.
I mean, I more or less covered it. Like it just reminds me of those movies that I grew up watching as a kid, like Empire Records or Clerks or things like that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I feel like there's a lot of high fidelity in there.
There is high, definitely, especially when it comes to like the questioning of like, where is this relationship going? Like man. Your relationship has to go with you as you grow.
Yeah.
And if you're growing beyond your relationship or your relationship's growing beyond you, then something needs to be adjusted. In the movie High Fidelity, his relationship was growing beyond him. He wanted to stay at the point that he was at, where he was like fantasizing about like young, sexy girls working at the comic shop or the record store where you know, but his lady was like, I'm moving on. Like this relationship is either going to grow or I'm going to grow without it.
We're not in our 20s anymore.
Right.
It's time. It's like, I'm age wise, I'm an adult now and I'm not only comfortable with that, I'm happy about it. Right. And I want to embrace that. It should be noted that Box Office Poison came out beforehand. So maybe High Fidelity.
Yeah. Well, now you gotta check it with Nick Hornby's book.
I don't know.
Which, if you've not read High Fidelity by the great Nick Hornby, read it. Like, I mean, it's almost verbatim the movie, because the movie was so passionate about staying close to the literature. Yeah. There was one scene in the book that I was like, oh, that wasn't in the movie. I checked the deleted scenes.
And it's the deleted scene. Yeah, yeah. I know the scene you're talking about, too. Kind of glad it was deleted.
It doesn't really add too much, but...
It took away... It told something about the character, but didn't give anything to the thrust of the story.
Right.
Which books and comics are allowed to do that. Mm-hmm. It's like, I'm going to take some time. Ideally, you want to... Every line of dialogue needs to say something about the character and move the story.
Right.
But you are allowed to pick one or the other.
I think movies lately forget that. Like, you think of the one scene in Pulp Fiction, the diner scene, where they're talking about Like a Virgin, and it has nothing to do with
Reservoir
anything.
Dogs.
What did I say? Pulp Fiction?
Yeah, that's
Reservoir Dogs. They're in the diner, they're talking about Madonna, Like a Virgin, has nothing to do with the plot, and has nothing to do with the characters, and tipping. I mean, that was one of those elements of like 90s indie filmmaking that was quintessential. It was one of the defining things where you could just stop and have a conversation about nothing just to have the audience feel engaged in the character's conversation.
It's not only that, the conversation has two moves. One, they all give their interpretation of Like a Virgin, and it's more or less the same. And then the second, they talk about the importance of tipping the waitress. In the first one, they're having a conversation that we all have. So I'm engaged. I get it. These people are like me. And the first part of the conversation is all of these guys are more or less the same guy. They all come from the same place and they all listen to the same music and they all think about it. And then the second half of the conversation is here is where and why they're different. It's like, so part A, here is how they're the same. Part B, here is how they're different. The whole conversation doesn't move the story until the end, but it says here are the characters and the least hackneyed. It's because what's happening now is like, okay, narrator, especially in animated movies, you've got that freeze frame. This is me. That's my dad. I'm going to describe our relationship. Like Ratatouille did that and it suffered for it. It's like, I watched the movie 3 times in a row because I have a small child. First time I watched it to watch it. And the second time, I pretend that there's no narration. Just like I mute during the narrated parts and keep playing, and I'm like, we could have kept following the story. You didn't have to give it to us. And I bet you some director somewhere said we have to give it to them because kids are watching this, and that kills me. Like, no, man, kids are not dumb. They'll ask the question out loud to their parents because parents are available, and Lord knows mine does. But if they just sit there and watch the movie, and if they've got a parent who just doesn't feel like dealing with that noise like me and just be like, sweetie, just watch the movie, you'll figure it out. They'll figure it out. All right, so tell me your like, did you like it? Did you not like it? I really dug it.
It's a really weighty book, so you gotta be invested.
Yeah.
You're gonna like it.
It goes in deep on it's an ensemble book. There's a main character, but it's about all of them.
Right. And
it goes in deep on all of them.
You start seeing yourself in certain characters and certain scenes, in certain interactions. You start paralleling it with your own life.
Now, here's I'm going to make a prediction about you personally. The main character's name is Sherman. When the book begins, Sherman just broke up with a longtime girlfriend. He just got his degree in English as a writer from NYU, and he works at a bookstore, and he doesn't like his job.
He works at a corporate book. They're like hinting, Barnes & Noble, Borders kind of bookstore. Yeah, not like a cool indie bookstore or anything like that.
So I'm thinking that you identified with Sherman pretty early on and you stuck with him for a good bit of
more or less.
But so like if you had to pick one guy, it would be Sherman.
I would say so.
Now this is, it's important to note that Sherman's best friend is an aspiring comic book maker. And Adam and I are both comic guys. And I, too, identified with Sherman in the beginning. But I bet that you shift your identification, I should say, about two-thirds of the way in. And you start getting sick of Sherman.
I don't think I got sick of Sherman so much as I got a little weary of the, like, constant arguing with his new girlfriend. Which, by the time you get to that point, it's no longer a new relationship. It's kind of like showing, like, when the honeymoon phase of a new relationship is over and you just kind of get to the dreariness. It's not that you get tired of them. It's just like, okay, well, if the only point of your character is to argue with the female character to show how a relationship can grow to be stale or argumentative, then I'm going to go check out what these characters are doing who actually are more engaged in something else.
These characters whose lives are still moving.
Right.
Because like with Sherman's girlfriend, it's not just we're outside of the honeymoon. It's what's beautiful is like you can interpret it's just the honeymoon is over, or you can interpret this is the part where red flags are appearing.
Mm-hmm.
And he's ignoring the red flags. And it's up to interpretation. Personally, I think red flags. I think he reached a point where they should have broken up far before it became an issue.
Right.
But I love, cause like the writer, Alex Robinson, I did as much dig on this person and listened to as many interviews as I could. And I bet it's going to sound weird and creepy and stalkery, but I bet we could hang out with this guy. Like I bet we'd be friends. Like, just you and me and all of our comic friends. Cause he's just a very down to earth guy. And somebody asked him, he's like, hey, the book kind of Sherman's your main character, but the book shifts away from him a good halfway through, two-thirds of the way through. And I appreciated that because I was kind of getting tired of Sherman. Why did you do that? And he said, I was getting tired of Sherman. Sherman is a sad little boy and he wasn't growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just where the character had to go. But I'm not interested in that character because he's stagnating and that's a fundamentally boring story. And I don't want to read that story. So I shifted more focus onto the characters that were moving.
Right.
And I think it made the book wonderful.
Right.
And kind of novel in that fact. Like, I haven't read almost everything I've read, both comic-wise and novel-wise, it's either about the ensemble equally, or they stick with their main character.
Mm-hmm.
They'll allow tangents, but the main character's from the beginning to the end. And there's some kind of satisfaction at the end. Either the whole world did everything it could, but the character doesn't change, i.e. Rorschach from Watchmen.
Right.
He's not the main character, but just that arc. The whole world changes, but this guy made the decision to refuse and stuck with it, and here's the consequence. Or here's your character, like High Fidelity, here's your character, watch him or her change over the course of this period. Whereas this book was, here's your main character, they stagnate, so we leave them.
Right.
It's kind of like we're the friends that he drifts apart from. It's putting us in the position of watching one of our friends fade, which is the big thing that happens in that stage of life. Like, it's after adolescence, but before genuine adulthood. Before you actually start actively planning and making decisions. Or for most people. I never had that period in my life. I got married when I was 21. I started making those decisions quick.
Speaking of you and your decisions, I'm going to start grilling you.
Lay it out, brother.
Where the hell is Purgatory Pub 2?
Oh, man. Okay.
Where is it?
That's a great question.
What's the deal? So to catch up the listeners. Gabe, X amount of years ago, came out with Purgatory Pub.
It debuted January of 2014. It was kickstarted November 2013.
You successfully had it. Another Kickstarter fund this year, or was that ending it last year?
In November 2014, I successfully Kickstarted.
So, you're behind on your deadline.
I am exceptionally behind.
You've had some run-ins. I know you and I have talked about it personally. Some things have come up. I mean, life happens.
And
that's why we haven't recorded in months this podcast.
Yeah, I'll tell you life all happens. About the life that happened.
I'm aware, but for the listeners who... maybe fans of your work, or may I say readers. Not assume that they like
the let's not assume anyone
just
likes
like I call it. I call our people listeners because they may not actually be fans. Like, what's going on?
I made this decision. I'm going to stop taking freelance clients and focus on the book, and that was a bad idea. Because we ran into just one or two household expenses, like this thing broke down, that thing broke down, and we started running out of money. And then I said, okay, it's time for me to start taking work again. And it wasn't happening. Just the fish were not biting. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of reasons, I took a hard look at my portfolio and I'm like, this is stagnant. I haven't updated in forever. I don't deserve to get work on this portfolio. And then just financial woe. Like, the very beginning of 2014, in January, we were in trouble. And the operating budget I had in my bank account for taking care of comic stuff, like buying tables at conventions and whatnot, I had to dump that into our savings to kind of bail us out financially. And I never pulled it out after our tax return. It's just like, I have to dump it. My family needs this. And it was time for me to get a day job. And that was a sad, depressing couple of months for a lot of reasons. And what it boils down to is the only skills that I've cultivated as an adult are drawing, illustrating,
and facial and hair writing,
and teaching drums.
Right.
And teaching drums. I lack a lot of things to do that professionally in this particular area. Like, the best way to teach drums, if I was going to teach drums professionally, what I'd want to do is become the assistant band director at a high school. Because the assistant band director, all they do is take care of the percussion kids.
Right.
They run the percussion ensemble, and they run the drum line during marching season, and they have the winter drum line during the winter season, and during the summer they do preseason stuff. And they keep all the percussion equipment, which is very, very temperamental and requires constant care, takes care of all of it. And it's a beautiful job. And North Carolina public school systems do not employ such a person regularly.
Right.
Some schools have guys who do it, but they fund them through band boosters. And way back in the day, before I graduated school, I had a long talk with my wife, and it wasn't feasible. It would mean more debt for more school in order to get a job where we'd probably have to move to Texas or Alabama, and neither of us wanted to. So the only other skill I've got is being an illustrator or being a writer. And my experience as a graphic designer, I go looking for illustration work. My portfolio is stagnant and sad, and the most recent work I have is a comic book that not enough people know about or are buying.
Mm-hmm.
And so I look for work as a graphic designer, and the requirements for being a graphic designer working in-house anywhere.
Oh, please shifted. Do tell. Please tell.
When I got into the graphic design department, I had a friend, I had a very, very close friend of the family who was doing it professionally and living in a big-ass house in Cary and raising three children and had this great lifestyle. And his freelance jobs, he was pulling in $75 an hour. And his design, while very competent and very good, is not exactly inspired. It's very clear it's just a job for him. So I said, all right, Matt, I'm going into this. What do I got to do? And he's like, nobody cares about your degree. You need a portfolio. And your portfolio, all it needs to show is that you know what Photoshop is and what Illustrator is. And if you want to be fancy, what InDesign is. Assuming you don't want to design for web, which I don't. All you need to know are those things and demonstrate that you know how to use them. And you will have work. And it was, for what it's worth, like I looked around and it was absolutely true. And then I went to school and I went through the graphic design department. And I got my English degree and I left. before, and with a minor in the graphic design section. And that had changed to where it's like, we need a 4-year degree in graphic design and 2 years experience before we hire you for entry level.
And do you edit video? Do you know code? Do you know PHP? Do you know HTML? Do you know CSS? Do you know XML? Do you know InDesign and print layout? Do you know how kerning and leading works? Do you know how to work my email? Do you know how to turn the lights on? Do you know?
Yeah, yeah. What kills me is I say, hey, I'm looking for a design job. I've designed and had printed these 2 issues of this magazine. Here are the 2 issues. I did all of this. I did all of this design. I've got the track record. I've got clients. I've got references. And then they say, this looks great. You do all right as a print designer for our company, and we're looking for a print designer. Do you know how to program in HTML5, PHP, CSS, and one other language?
Oh, by the way, do you also know Maya and AutoCAD and FlexSign and...
Yeah, so it's the job market was we need... What kills me is it's like that's a separate discipline. That's literally a programmer. The long and the short was the only skill I had wasn't good enough to get me work. I got a job at a screen printing house, pulling t-shirts off of a conveyor belt, which, for the record, I actually really liked that job.
Right on.
I love the people that I worked with. My bosses were great. The work itself was lovely because I'd show up and I say, hey, boss, what are we doing today? He says, we are printing the front, the back, and the sleeve of 1,000 shirts. And at the end of the day, I burnt my fingers, I'm covered in ink, but there's a stack of 1,000 shirts and they're done. It's like, boom, I did my job today. I earned my money. But it was 10 hours a day, 5 days a week. So 50-hour weeks on your feet all day. Screen printing requires that the shirts be passed underneath an oven. There are 4 industrial-sized ovens on all day during the North Carolina summer. And some days, my wife couldn't be home with Ivy, so I'd have to drop her off at a daycare. And I've got to be at work at 7. So my daughter would spend, between the time it takes to get to and from the daycare, my daughter would spend 12-hour days at this daycare for just above minimum wage. And then from there, I got a nice and cushy office job for half the time. Less than half the time and about the same money, doing sales for a graphic design company. It's a very small mom and pop shop, a great company, Brandilli Marketing and Creative, BrandilliMC.com. Great company. I'm going to get some stuff printed for NC Comic Con. I'm going to print with them.
Nice.
Yeah. Great company, great people, and they do solid work, and they gave me a real chance. And just some financial stuff happened, and they couldn't keep me on.
Right.
And it's just one of those, it's nobody's fault. We all gave it our best. It just didn't work out.
Sure.
And I got laid off from that. So during the time where, like, it's just, I can't pick up my pencil. So for this space of 4 or 5 months, it's just, I'm not picking up my pencil. I can't. And furthermore, my family can't afford me to do that either. Got laid off. And then luckily, I landed a freelance gig, which floated me for 2 weeks. During those 2 weeks, I picked up a kid's book job, which is, as far as kid books go, is low paying, but it's enough to float me for a month or two if I stretch it. And then during that time, I revamped the portfolio and put out some feelers, and 2 board game clients just appeared. I just signed, finished negotiations, and got the deposit from one of them this morning. So now I've got enough work and enough money to float me until January comfortably. And so during this time, it's like, oh, I finally have time to do all the other stuff. Like, I finished, at the time that I had to stop production on the book, I had all of it drawn and penciled, and I was very slowly inking. And then when I got the half-time job as a sales guy, I got to ink a lot more. So I finished inking, and I did some grays, and then I got laid off, and then very, very quickly, knocked out all the grays, stop, revamp the portfolio, come back, letter this chapter, stop, do some more behind-the-scenes stuff, put out feelers for work. So where I'm at right now, the whole book is drawn, grayed, inked. The visuals are all done. It's 4 chapters. Two medium-sized chapter, 1 short chapter, and 1 long chapter. all of it is lettered. I have to letter the one long chapter and the one short chapter. And that's what's happening this weekend. Is
awesome.
This weekend I will letter the short chapter. And I'm hoping that by the time NC Comic Con rolls around, I will have sent, I will have a proof of the book in my hands.
Cool.
So that I, what I was supposed to do was have this book out by convention season. And if financially we hadn't hit the skids as hard as we did, it's like some things that happened. Our refrigerator died,
right,
and didn't need repair, needed replace.
Right.
And in that same, the next week, our hot water heater died. Yeah. It just reached life expectancy.
Life happens, man.
Yeah. Life expectancy died, needed to be replaced. The brakes on one of our cars died, needed to be replaced. So, I mean, just financially, shit hit the fan. Had to stop and get actual work.
But you're back on track.
I'm back on track, and my backers, this is beautiful. I lapsed. I didn't put an update for a month and a half.
Right.
And one person put up a comment, said, "Hey, not rushing, not trying to be a heel, just an update would be nice. Just a very, very polite, very, very gentle, mm-hmm, let us know what's going on." And I threw it up. Here's what's happening. I'm really, really sorry. And the first response I got back was, oh yeah, man, same thing happened to me. Like, the hot water heater busted and then a tree fell and broke the roof.
Wait, what's the deal with these hot water heaters? Are they, like, made of, like glass? All of them break at the same time, apparently.
They last for years and years, so it's just you forget it's there.
Yeah.
And you forget it's there until all of a sudden it breaks and just water is everywhere.
That's why you don't keep your comic collection next to your water heater.
No. And our water heater is actually on the outside of our house, which is pretty... There's this little closet addition that was added to the house.
Right.
So it's enclosed, but it's outside of the house. So if there's a catastrophic failure,
right,
it won't affect us.
Yeah, that's good.
It's pretty sweet. The plumber, the contractor and the plumber who did this to my house before I moved in, live in my neighborhood.
Really?
The plumber lives directly across the street from me. The contractor lives catty corner.
Well, now you know who to go to when something goes wrong.
Yeah, and that's the trick. Like, my stuff broke. I walked across the street, knocked on the door, says, "Hey, man, here's my problem. Can you help me out?" And he's like, "I'll get my tools. I'll be there in 10 minutes. And he's the guy who installed it in the first place. Yeah. He knows exactly what he's doing. And costs less than half of anyone else I called. It was beautiful.
Fantastic.
So it's like stuff was bad, but not bad bad. You know what I mean? It's just comics.
So you can assure... Your readers and listeners that it's happening.
It will happen, and it will be out in time for next convention season. I mean, hopefully it'll be ready before Christmas, but
this year's Tickle Me Elmo?
It will not. I will never make a this year's Tickle Me Elmo. Oh man, if I ever do that, I could die happy, man.
Yeah, right.
I'm richer than God, but hopefully, like, I kickstarted the book. And a solid year after it was kickstarted, he did the same thing I'm doing. It was a solid year after kickstarting that he threw up the update and said, "I'm sorry, things happened. You'll have your book very soon." And what he did was he said, "It's been a year. I made a lot of promises. I'm just going to take even more time to finish." It was book three of what should have been four book series. He said, "I'm going to take more time. And I'm just going to finish the series with this because I don't think these people are going to trust me again." And luckily, I think that my backers have been very, 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 very patient with me.
Right.
So I think that they would trust me again. But also, I'm not going to kickstart until I say, "Here it is. It is done."
Right.
"It is all done. I will show you the proof to the camera. It's done this time."
Well, that's good advice for anybody who's considering starting their own Kickstarter campaign.
Yeah.
Know your limitations, and if you can already produce the product, maybe not the whole run of it, but enough to be like, "This is essentially it."
Yeah, well, see, like, that's the trick. That's what I did.
Yeah.
It's my deadline was my first convention appearance on the books, which was in April, and I kickstarted in November. It's like, I can absolutely finish this by April with a little margin of error. I could probably finish this by February. But I ran into trouble, and it's not just things slowed down. They stopped
right
for 4 months and then were slow for one more month. And it was, for the record, it was a sad, sad period of time, and I realize I never want to make a living without my pencil ever again.
Words to live by.
Yeah.
So this is going to wrap up the return to No Big 2. How do you feel?
I feel good. I tell you what, man. I want to do more of these. And you know what I want to do? I want to do some obscure indie stuff. Like, I want to go in-depth.
You know more about the really obscure stuff than I do. So, like, I am a hipster. It's hard to even find it, let alone, like, know where to look. So, like, yeah, definitely if we...
You know what? I've got a middle ground. I've got a way that you can find it with.
It's called Google?
No, it's not that. Well, first of all, the reason I know any of this stuff is because I spend a good portion of... every con I go to, going table to table and finding people I haven't met yet. This past Heroes was amazing.
Yeah.
I'm still not done reading through those books. But what we can do, you and me, we can go to kablam.com and shop all the self-published books that are on there and say, this one looks good, and we can both buy a copy.
Yeah, no, that sounds good.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, for those of you listening, if you want to find out just the absolutely... like. Here's a bit of reality that I preach as regularly as I can. All the jokes that Joss Whedon puts into any of his movies came out in an indie comic 20 years ago. This is not an indictment. This is not an attack. This is not me being like, oh, screw Whedon. No, not at all. This is the way that it's always been. The hit movie that comes out, and I'm not talking just superhero movies. Like, think The Crow. The Crow was a breakout hit. It was a terrific movie. I love it to death. But it was... a fantastic comic that came out several years before. So if you want to be on just the most cutting edge of where not American culture is, but where it will be 10 years from now, 20 years from now, you can do it. You can find the most obscure, up-and-coming, self-published stuff right now for cheap, because the print-on-demand websites like Kablam make all of their stuff publicly available. You can go on there, find something you've never seen before, never heard of before, and never seen creator before. And what people don't seem to understand is that just because they're not working at Marvel or DC or Dark Horse or whatnot, doesn't mean that they're not talent. Right. There is a lot of deep quality talent out there in the world right now, in every art form, that you have never heard of and will never hear of until you go looking. So please, throw out one website, Kablam, kablam.com. Go there, decide what genre you want to read, and they'll have a title of books that are like 100 pages long. Just page after internet, page after page after page of books for you to choose from. And what's beautiful is most of them have little previews, because when you're getting on cutting edge of anything, of the newest stuff coming out, let's be real, there's a lot of garbage. There's a lot of garbage. There's a lot of people who are on their way up because their talent is not there yet.
Right.
But there's also a lot of very undiscovered, very, very good stuff. And it's free. It's free to do this shopping. It's
fantastic.
Free to do the shopping. And the books themselves, you can have them mail directly to you, printed on demand for fairly cheap. Or there might be an option to read them as a DRM-free PDF. Nice. So if you want to find you some indie books, some obscure... amazing, nobody else has read it, this could be like kind of like all those shitty indie rock kids in college, like, oh, this is my music, and then everyone hears it and they hate it and they want to drop it. If you want that, if you want to be that indie kid
for comics, you want your own Death Cab for Cutie,
yeah, if you want your own pre-2005 Death Cab for Cutie in comic form, ka-blam.com is one of the easiest ways to find it. And the next time we do one of these No Big 2, I can tell you how to find more badass shit. Also, try this. Go to your local comic shop, go to their back issues, and just pick a random long box and start flipping through it. Because, say, I was flipping through Cyberforce, just because I did this. I went and I just closed my eyes and picked a long box. I flipped through Cyberforce, and there's a very short run of an indie book called Cyber Frog in the middle of it. And you would miss it because it's not labeled, because it's such a short run black and white indie. But it was so funny. It was a real, real treasure. It was it was a hidden buried treasure. So the two ways, this is your homework if you're listening, ka-blam.com, Kablam, and look through the books that they'll print for you and find you.
Fingers go swimming.
Oh, fingers go swimming. I thought you said something far dirtier.
No, fingers go swimming.
Yeah.
And go to your local comic shop, go to the back issues, and find an obscure title you've never heard of before, and just take a look in your shop.
That's gonna wrap it up.
Wrap it up. Thank you so much for listening to this edition of No Big 2 Review. Sequoia, we miss you so stinking bad, dude. Come on. Come back.
All right, everybody. Have a good one.